Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The big GM wobble this week over workers and wages and whether its factories will be built in this country was just one more wake-up call. The old world is gone, and the new one is going to require a lot more innovation if America is going to stay at the top of the economic heap. So today, we're checking in with three young, world-beating American innovators on the path to breakthroughs right now about what it takes and how they do it. And we'll hear from a Big View innovation guru who says we'd better get cracking. Up next on Point, message to America on innovation: lead, follow, or get out of the way. We're going to turn in a moment to three young innovators on a roll, Anita Goel, David Berry, and Garrett Camp, to hear their stories and judge. They're with me in the studio today. Anita, Garrett, David, welcome. Great to have you.
How's it going? Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to have all of you here. But first, for a quick overview of America's innovation challenge, we turn to John Keough, a longtime Harvard Business School professor, now based in San Francisco. His new book is Innovation Nation. He joins us today from New York. John Keough, welcome.
Tom, thanks for having me on the show.
Give it to us quick and dirty, John. What are we up against on the innovation front?
Well, I think there are two things going on. One is that the rest of the world is becoming a lot smarter about innovation. You know, after World War II, there was one big mountain peak on the innovation landscape, and it was the U.S. And we actually innovated the process of innovation with venture capital and the emergence of Silicon Valley and our leading universities and education policies. But while the rest of the world is now catching up, and in some instances, I think, even surpassing what we have here in the U.S., our own engine appears to be showing some signs of wear. If you do a report card on our performance in teaching our young about science and math, it's pretty dismal. You look at our broadband penetration, it's number 24 worldwide, depending upon what surveys you look at.
That is broadband high-speed internet connections, you mean there?
Well, and exactly. And our broadband is often a little slower than the broadband, say, in Korea or Japan or other countries. If you look at our government's approach to supporting R&D through tax credits and other fiscal policies, again, we're somewhere way down in the 20s rather than the number one or, you know, in the top five that one might expect. So I think that there's ample reason to be concerned about the situation in the U.S., not because there aren't hot spots of excellence in Boston, where I lived for 20 years, or in San Francisco, where I've now been for about 10 years, but because it's the way you phrased the question at the beginning. How does this relate to our overall national economic health? And while we may have still the sharp end of the innovation spear in America and for a long time to come because of our values and the kind of our approach to risk and exploration, it may well be that we're going to be part of a kind of an innovation world phenomenon where capital and talent and ideas are going to flow from many places to many places, and in which case we're going to have to really be thinking about what our competitive posture is with regard to our own innovation capabilities and think about that wisely as a country.
And I guess the answer is obvious, but there is no guarantee of the U.S. winning this global economic competition.
Well, exactly right. Now, many people will frame this as a kind of competitive race, and I see it really more as building the kind of capabilities that every society wants. You know, every society wants to have a better way of dealing with its issues of education and social welfare and national security and so forth and so on. But I think that what I see is almost the leader of the pack, so to speak, and America has always been the indispensable nation for innovation, beginning kind of unilaterally to slow down, and slow down for a variety of reasons that I hope we're going to have a national conversation about over the coming year.
Well, and over this coming hour as well. John Keough, the new book is Innovation Nation, How America is Losing Its Innovation Edge, Why It Matters, and How We Can Get It Back. We're delighted that you're with us. Please stick with us through this hour and listen along with us. We really value your perspective here. A part of what we want to do is to talk with people who are at the tip of that innovation spear about what they're doing, how they're doing it, how they feel about the environment in which they're doing it. And I want to begin to turn to them now, John. If you can stand by there in New York, I've got a great crowd with me in the studio. I've got, three of the brightest, most cutting-edge scientists, thinkers, innovators in the land, handpicked by MIT's Technology Review and named Top Innovators Under 35. Let's begin to really meet them. First, David Barry, 29 years old. He's this year's Tech Review Innovator of the Year. That is, out of those 35, under 35. He's an MD with a PhD in biology. His company, LS9, is producing genetically engineered microbes to produce biofuels. Could be huge. He's also a principal at Flagship Ventures, a venture capital firm in Cambridge, Massachusetts. David, first to you, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much.
So I'm reading this off the sheet, but tell us in your words, and I know you've got a lot of things going on, but on the microbiofuel front, what are you doing?
So working at LS9, what we're really trying to do is take existing microbes and engineer them so that they can have entirely new biochemical pathways that allow them to take glucose or any sort of glucose-like molecule, i.e. cellulose or anything along those lines, and convert it very efficiently into something that looks like, smells like, and acts like, and frankly is, petroleum. So essentially making what we like to call renewable petroleum.
So this is not just a new way of distilling ethanol. It's something else?
Completely distinct from ethanol. It's making a molecule that is identical to what we want to dig up from the ground today, something that we could put into a blender, put into a cat cracker, or put right into a vehicle and use in our existing infrastructure so that we're basically not changing anything, getting high energy value, and continuing to use the same sort of product but do it renewably.
And what do you put into the mixing, the blender here? Is it a bunch of corn or switchgrass or something else that the bio microbes go to work on?
We've developed this so that it's agnostic to what the input can be. It can be a cellulose, so it can be switchgrass, miscanthus, anything along those lines. It can use sugar from, say, Brazil. We didn't want to pre-specify that because that's another nut that needs to be cracked, and we wanted to be able to work with whatever's the best going forward.
Ethanol has the rap of being just barely better than gasoline because it takes so much energy to produce it in the first place. What about your goal?
Well, the problem with ethanol is that if you compare ethanol straight up gallon per gallon to petroleum, it has two-thirds of the energy value. It's difficult to distribute because of the volumes, the corrosion, and other sorts of issues. And what we can do is harness the beneficial effects of ethanol, i.e. using a plant that originally gets its carbon from the air to make it relatively to entirely carbon neutral, and use that to produce something that's a more energy-dense molecule, something that works with our pipeline, with our infrastructure, and in our cars, and really take advantage of what are the shortfalls of ethanol today.
Okay. We're going to learn more about that, but it's head-turning. Alternative fuel, energy in a test tube, in a blender here, kind of pulled out of the air. Sounds big, and no doubt some think it will be. Anita, let me come to you. Anita Goel was named Top Innovator in 2005. She's also an MD with an extra doctorate in physics, who started a company that is building a handheld device capable of instant detection and identification of infectious disease with molecular analysis. Her company is NanoBioSim. It just landed a $2 million contract with the Pentagon. Anita, please tell us what you're up to.
NanoBioSim focuses on creating innovation at the confluence or convergence of physics, medicine, and nanotechnology. And one of these outputs has been this gene radar technology, which we've been developing with a lot of encouragement from the Department of Defense, which is, if I could describe it, imagine a future cell phone-like device in which you could put a drop of blood or saliva and within a few minutes be able to read out what kind of infectious disease a person has.
So I'm on a battlefield or in a jungle or just at home.
Yes.
And what? I get a drop of blood or a little saliva and it goes to work with molecular analysis and tells me what the problem is if I'm feeling poorly.
That's the idea.
How close?
Very close, with very high sensitivity, with sort of a nanoscale precision.
How close to achieving this, to putting this in people's hands?
We're still a couple of years away minimum, because it's still an early stage technology that we're taking. It's a nanotechnology platform, and many milestones have to be done before we get it into a real product.
But the ambition sounds enormous, and presumably both in terms of, I mean, the benefit and the commercial opportunity, huge.
The commercial opportunity is huge, especially when you look worldwide. If you look at developing world countries as well, where people don't have access to basic health care, you can envision freeing ourselves from the shackles of the infrastructure, having a mobile device that you could take out into the fields, into rural villages.
Okay, it's exciting. One more. Garrett Camp is with us, also one of this year's list of the top 35 Tech Review innovators under 35, a 28-year-old Canadian now living and working in San Francisco. He helped create StumbleUpon, software that helps web users find better websites. Garrett, is your message, watch out Google?
I wouldn't say that. At StumbleUpon, we are actually trying to develop a recommendation engine which doesn't specifically try to find something for you when you search, but instead suggest interesting information that you might like. So basically, the use case is you say what you like, specify your interests, new topics, rate a whole bunch of websites, and then it will automatically bring interesting information to you that have been recommended by either friends or like-minded people.
Does this change the world?
I believe that does change the way people, or in the future will change the way people retrieve information. Because it's kind of like reverse search. Instead of you going out and trying to find information, information will automatically flow to you. And it's a personalized service so that everyone will automatically get information that is relevant to them.
You're doing it in San Francisco, not Canada. Why?
I actually did my studies in Canada, but I had the opportunity to move down to San Francisco and work with some really great people. And I believe that in the web industry, San Francisco is still the kind of epicenter of innovation.
With me in the studio, three rocking and rolling innovators, Anita Goel, David Berry, Garrett Camp. All young, all at the top ranks of innovators, as judged by Technology Review magazine. Also with us from New York City, based in San Francisco, but in New York today, John Keough, author of Innovation Nation. And John, let me turn to you just first for a quick take on what you're hearing from the three who I'm sitting with here in Boston today. Is this the future? Is this the great hope? Is this sufficient?
Well, what I heard made me very excited. I'd love to have some time with each one of the three of them to just talk more about their businesses and about their dreams for the future. So I think that what they're sharing with us is exciting on many levels, not just because the technology is exciting or the business opportunity is exciting, but also because, to me, they exemplify a couple of trends in, let's say, the young innovator cohort, which I find very exciting. One is the whole idea of interdisciplinary approaches. So it's not life sciences or physical sciences, but something, for instance, at the intersection that is the font of new knowledge. And also the other theme is that every one of these technologies is about making the world a better place. And I often say if innovation is the big answer that we're looking for, what's the question? You know, what's it for besides making money for venture capitalists? And obviously, There seems to be a socially minded impulse behind each one of these. The thing that I'm concerned about, though, wouldn't be these three, who I think represent kind of an all-star band of innovation, but all of the people who may have been like them, but who didn't wind up having the opportunities, being surrounded by a value system and an ethos, getting the support, having the education to express their talents in a similar way. You know, we're a country that spends more money on astrology than on astronomy. We granted more doctorates in parks and recreation than we did in cultural studies and language studies last year. And so there's a real question about not the very top of the bell curve, but really what's happening to our society as a whole in terms of being an innovation engine for the future.
Well, let's mix it up with our innovators here. David Berry, let me come to you. I mean, you're clearly, John calls this an all-star band. All right, you've got an MD from Harvard, a PhD in biology from MIT. We're not grabbing you at random off the street. On that path that you've been on, and it's a very high arc path, how lonely is it? Do you feel a culture that has supported you in that? Do you feel part of an innovative American mainstream or like an outlier?
I think there's a lot of different elements there. Broadly, there's a lot of people, I think, going down these paths. There's a lot of people thinking about important problems, in particular in the biological engineering division at MIT, in particular at Harvard Medical School.
And right across this country, you can find centers in Madison, Wisconsin, and in California, obviously, and, you know, you name it.
Well, exactly. I think across the country, we're finding hotbeds of innovation left and right. One of the things that I think we as a country need to continue to work on is make sure that our workforce is motivated towards achieving the goals of innovation. And I think by having some of these hotbeds in Boston and San Francisco that are also popping up throughout the rest of the nation, it's really going to support an innovation nation going forward. What we see in Boston is really one of the peaks in the country. And the fact that we have so many top innovators, so much of the top talent has allowed us to achieve on a very broad and very important basis. For example, looking at the life sciences over the past 30 years, we're now sitting at the cutting edge of energy. We're hoping to make this a central point for the country for energy with some of our companies that we're putting together now and some of the ones in the future.
And a lot of other parts of the country hoping to do the same thing, whether it's in California with a big push there or in the Midwest with something out of biomass fuels.
Well, exactly. And I think the fact that it's happening all over the country, that Boston and San Francisco are both playing central roles, that we're seeing a lot coming out of, say, Iowa, Denver, Chicago, Texas, it's a great feeling for the country. I'd like to see more and more of it continue to grow and not just have two major hotspots as well as some others that are focusing on it.
Anita Goel, if I recall correctly, you grew up in Mississippi.
That's right.
Now here you are at this very high tier, you know, MD, PhD in physics, at this confluence, as you put it, of physics, medicine, and biotechnology. What was the motivator that took you from Mississippi to this kind of educational peak and now on the sort of high arc of innovation?
In a way, I think it all began there. I grew up in a rural town in Mississippi where black people and white people lived on different sides of the railroad. My parents were immigrants from India. And I learned at a young age to position myself at the interface. And I think that there's a tremendous opportunity when we start to look at the confluence of disciplines. And America is uniquely poised to capitalize upon innovation that happens when we integrate the different disciplines and where they've gotten.
Why uniquely? Why can't any country look at at all the sciences and beyond and say, let's put them together?
Well, historically, America has had an edge when the reductionistic paradigm sort of dominated in holding the innovation edge in each of these disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're uniquely positioned to integrate those, whereas many of the other countries today are still developing that edge in maybe certain areas. We're uniquely positioned to take the next leap and to actually start integrating those reductionistic sort of capabilities that we had developed sort of, by that I mean in each specific discipline.
Right. You may still have relatives in India. You must be aware of all the innovation that's going on there. How do you think these environments compare? Can you say?
Absolutely. Actually, in more ways than one, I have seen what kind of initiatives, for example, the Indian government is trying to take. I think that, to be fair, there is a lot of underdog mentality in a lot of other countries, which gives them an extra drive to really invest top-down in innovation.
So do you see America now as a goner or a winner?
I think we have to be careful. I think America is kind of at the teeter-tottering edge where we could go either way. But I think we have certain elements which are very unique, which, if properly leveraged, could really help America sustain and develop continuing innovation edges.
Garrett Camp, you're a Canadian drawn to the United States, presumably by what's going on here. On the internet front, it's going to be huge, obviously. Do you see America had early dominance? It was born here. Do you see that continuing?
I think so. I mean, I know in Canada, like, they've got, you know, very good education systems, but it was still people from America who kind of reached out and encouraged me to come down and develop the ideas. So I definitely noticed there was a proactivity and a culture of kind of taking risks that I noticed in San Francisco that definitely kind of encourages development.
Do you, as a Canadian, still see the United States generally as a beacon of innovation or not?
I think it's pretty innovative. I mean, I think there's a lot of innovation going on everywhere, but this is definitely a place where it's I don't know, to me, I feel like it's encouraged a lot.
So. Let's go to our listeners. Julia is calling from Preston, Iowa. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm an educator. I'm often frustrated with our current educational system. There's a focus on the middle and testing. My husband and I often say that it's not just no child left behind, it's no child allowed ahead.
Yeah.
And
ouch.
I'm wondering if you had mentors or accelerated classes, what about your early educational system in junior high or high school gave you the energy and the inspiration and the motivation to achieve the things that you have?
Let's ask. David Barry?
I've had a very supportive family all along who's helped me achieve whatever goal I'd want to and really sought out extracurricular sorts of activities to...
Public school?
I was in private school.
Private school. So, you know, you weren't in the mainstream from the get-go right there because your parents thought it wasn't good enough?
I wouldn't say that. It was more that it was an opportunity that I could have. It really helped me, I think, to focus on my early interests in math and science. But even in that setting, I still pursued a number of extracurricular activities, mm-hmm. and it was, I think, a set of interests that I had to have the energy and the interest to pursue on my own and make sure that I got the full set of activities that I needed.
So private school and above and beyond even there, did you feel supported culturally growing up? Did the broader culture say, David, get on the path to PhDs and MDs and science and all the rest?
Well, I think when you're a young kid, no one is really supporting directly math and science. It's more you're dealing with the bully sort of economy of middle school and whatnot.
Right.
But as long as it's something that you know you're interested in, I think there's definitely opportunities for people to go out and pursue.
Anita, you got on the education path in Mississippi. How did you end up here? What were you facing at the get-go?
Certainly, I would thank supportive parents and a supportive family, which is where it began. I think that I was selective in always finding encouragement in the environment. I think it's always there. There are factors which may take you in other directions, but there are always elements of encouragement. It's sort of how you
process.
Public
school?
Private school.
Private school again. Did that make a difference?
It did.
Private school in Mississippi or outside?
In Mississippi.
Okay, so another beam. And, of course, Garrett, you got yours in Canada. John Cale, what about education over it all? You raised big flags around it in your book, Innovation Nation.
I think education is the big silent factor, silent in the sense that there are no obvious pain points from day to day that will either tip us in a forward or a retrograde direction. If we don't have an educated cohort of young talents coming into our society, we'll be outsourcing innovation to other countries at a ferocious rate who've gotten the education equation right. You know, there's a reason why Finland is rated the number one education country in the world. It's because they pay their teachers incredibly well. It's because every time there's an opening for a job in a school, there are multiple applications. Teachers are honored in society. Education is valued. And so the educational enterprise has a real integrity to it.
Julia in Iowa says, she sees no child left behind as no child allowed ahead. Are we raising the center but capping the top? Is that a problem?
Well, of course it is. I mean, I think we want to have an education system that's pluralistic. In other words, people who are disadvantaged can be lifted up. People who are exceptional can get into educational arcs that go beyond the conventional structure of curricula, and the mainstream can get an education that prepares them to be good contributing members of society. And I'm imagining that we are falling down on each one of those. I think that education is fundamentally important. It's not an option. And if you look at the countries that are, forging ahead in the innovation arena, if you look at China's policies towards innovation, for instance, China, which the Politburo, you know, this is the Communist Party of China. Now, yeah. Innovation is their top national priority. And, of course, the other thing is they're pursuing education like a nation possessed. They make a very explicit connection between the ability to innovate and the prowess that they want to have in science and technology and the investment that they're putting into education. We need to do the same thing. We need to make being smart sexy again.
Anita, David, let me just ask you, in your field, do you feel directly the heat from China or India, for that matter? Do you feel direct competition, or do you know?
I think there's definitely competition in China. And the thing that frankly scares me the most is that we're educating a number of their best and their brightest at our top universities right now. And because of some of the issues we have with our visa program, sending them right back to China and fueling their innovation engine.
They might have stayed here. Now they may be going home.
Exactly.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me get a call from Somerville, South Carolina. Jan, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I see a problem. There's sort of a combination of forces that want to keep, let's say biofuels, for example, that want to keep that competition out between the American Petroleum Institute, the press, you know, puts down corn ethanol, for example, which actually works very well, and so we're all going to be hungry because of it, when there are lots of other crops even that could be used. And then on the peer review side, in the universities and the federal government, you know, the more complicated it is, the more excited we get about it. Whereas I think if you look at innovators in other countries, they're looking for simple, straightforward solutions. For example, NASA spent tons of money trying to get a pen to write in outer space. The Russians said, hey, let's use a pencil. You know, we waste a lot of money on complicated solutions when clear, straightforward thinking, like, say, take the PC computer, solved the problem a lot easier than what IBM wanted to come up with.
Jen, you got a lot on the table for us there. Let us pick it up, and let's go first to, we've talked about education. Let's talk about, I don't know, vested interests. And David, this may come first to you. Do you feel, Jan suggests, there may be a headwind against innovation on the energy front? Okay, here you are. You're looking at getting microbes genetically altered to sort of to produce alternative fuels. Do you feel the powers that be, the vested interests, somehow arrayed against you, sabotaging, you know, pushing back, or not? Is it an open road?
There's really two forces pushing at the same time. You see a lot of government and big company activities that are trying to keep the status quo going. My favorite example being a GAO line that allows big oil companies to depreciate fivefold the value of infrastructure that they're building.
So that's a real favor to big oil.
Exactly. But at the same time, you have these same big oil companies who are making substantial investments in universities, who are talking with small companies and trying to figure out really what is the future going to be. Their goal, of course, is to stay alive. Their goal is to be profitable. And they are starting to recognize that things are going to change in the future.
On balance, do you feel boxed in or free to innovate on the energy front?
I've been feeling pretty free. There's a lot of support, I think, when you have ideas that feel like they can be game-changing, mm-hmm. when you're openly engaging the people who are going to be the customers, the people that you would want to work with mm-hmm. down the road. People are pretty supportive of it, but of course you need to prove it.
Anita Goel, Jan also says maybe we're looking for answers that are too complicated. I mean, you're at the confluence of physics and medicine and biotechnology to put this sort of super infectious disease detector in a cell phone-sized device. Maybe just more barefoot doctors around the world would be just as good or better.
I think that they often say necessity is the mother of invention. And one of the things we as a country can focus on is looking at sort of what are the needs that we have? What are simple solutions to opportunities that are out there? And I think that Perhaps one of the risks we have is becoming too complacent as a society, thinking we're already on top of the world and not thinking simply, as Jan suggested. But I think that having that perspective, which I like in John's book, is thinking, how can we make the world a better place? That creates problems for us to solve. So we can now leverage our science, our technologies, with a perspective that's global. And I think that that is a motivation. That's a driver of innovation.
Your product may look complex, but is it the new normal? I mean, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, will we accept this kind of confluence of fields around breakthroughs? I mean, the automobile was once incredibly complex. Will yours someday, out of some country, be the norm?
I hope. I definitely hope so.
Wow. Let's take a call from Portland, Maine, and Jeffrey. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question. I work in research and development tax credits. I actually work, my company is the Lion Group out of Houston, but I run our New England practice.
Yeah.
So I've looked at hundreds of companies from Portland, Maine, where I'm on the way to now, down to Connecticut, specifically for capturing, helping them to capture their R&D credits. So I guess my question is for your guests, if they're aware of R&D tax credits, if the credits have benefited their companies at all yet, and also, if they'd like to see the government offer more robust credits. Our credits, as strong as they are significantly weaker than many of our competitors, particularly our industrialized competitors around the world.
Jeffrey, let us pick it up, and thanks very much. Anita, first to you. The Defense
Yes.
Department has given you a $2 million contract, but that's different from tax credits. Do you feel favored, supported by U.S. tax policy treatment?
I think the policy certainly helped us. We have benefited from the tax credits. I can tell you that there are other countries that do a lot more in terms of subsidizing research and giving incentives to companies who do R&D. So I think that my answer is somewhere in between. I think that certainly my company has benefited from some of the R&D tax credits, but I think there a lot more could be done to really help companies who want to do innovation and do research You know, you need to sustain a company through that death valley or the valley of death to get to the point where they're revenue positive. And I think that if you want to really encourage innovation in this country, you have to create some of that environment. And the government can do a lot to help that.
John Kao, where do you see the needle? We've got big subsidies for lots of industries in this country these days, a lot for agriculture, plenty for petroleum. You know, do we tilt to the new, to the innovative, or away from it?
Well, I think as a culture and a society, we tilt towards the new. But if we focus on this question of R&D tax credits and other kinds of subsidies, I love being evidence-based where it's possible in this field. And
yes.
According to the OECD, America's number 17 worldwide in terms of offering incentives and subsidies for research and development, and it's really perplexing as to why that should be the case. Furthermore, if we look at R&D as a percentage of GDP, right, just sort of the percentage of our gross budget that we spend on R&D, we're 11th in the world. I mean, on an absolute basis, we spend more than any other country because, you know, we have a big GDP, but as a percentage of GDP, R&D is low. And so why should this be? Why shouldn't we be taking our wealth, and we are still a wealthy country, and investing it more wisely in priming the pump, and not just in basic research, but in the mechanisms to create the bridges from the laboratory to the development lab, the design lab.
Yeah, but John, I think the question I'm asking there is, do existing big interests kind of have a lock on those resources? There are billions of dollars in all kinds of subsidies for existing industries. Is that locking up what should be spent on new frontiers?
Well, I think to some extent it is. If we look at the macro level, if we look at our national balance sheet, we're kind of strapped for money these days. You know, we spend $2 billion a day just servicing our debt. We're spending a lot of money for the war in Iraq. And we also have a lot of vested interests. And, you know, unlike a lot of these insurgent countries like China, let's say, the newly resurgent China or Singapore or Finland, we're an incumbent. We've been around for a while. Our institutions are you know, let's say middle-aged, to be polite.
Yep.
And so it's easier for us to kind of improve what we already have than to invest resources in a new way to get to something disruptive and radically new. And obviously, we need both, but we're doing a little less well, I think, on the disruptive innovation side than on just kind of improving what we know. So, yeah, I think vested interests are necessary, precisely because they are vested in institutions of society. But if they crowd out the new in terms of competition for resources, that's clearly not a good thing.
Let's take a call from Des Moines, Iowa, and Kyle. Kyle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to comment on the education and bringing in the best and brightest from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an excellent way to battle our problem for paying for the baby boomers. That's something that my generation is going to have to do.
You mean import talent from overseas to help offset the boomers graying?
Yeah, and then on top of which, we'll also benefit on, you know, what you guys have been talking about research and innovation. I think it's, you know, we can benefit in two different ways from this situation. I personally have a friend from Nepal who is actually getting his master's. He got his bachelor's, and the only way he could stay in this country was to continue his education by getting his master's. And even after that, he may not be able to stick around.
Do you think, Kyle, we're going to end up in competition for other countries? Are we already for the best and brightest globally? Are we going to see, I don't know, you know, the next Garrett Camp from Canada not going to San Francisco but to Shanghai?
I think right now America is still probably the front runner. A lot of people want to come to this country. We're very attractive and we're a great country to be in. But if we don't act and address some of these problems, we may lose. I personally foresee China becoming a superpower within, you know, 20 to 50 years, even above this country, if we don't start taking the right action.
Kyle, thanks very much for that. David Berry, you raised the same issue. And, you know, there is, I mean, China, as I understand it, is planning to build real global universities, drawing people from all around the world in a way that they never have before, and is way into that already. Do you see other magnets that could bleed away that global talent from this country?
Well, very much so. You look at what China and India are doing, and they're producing four times the number of engineers that we are. The truth of the matter, though, is that we're taking some of their best and their brightest, educating them here and sending them back. If we were to have a little bit more of an open-door policy, i.e. staple on a green card to everyone who gets a PhD from a top institution here, I think
At home. Stick around.
Exactly. We want to encourage those sort of people to stay in the U.S., get educated in the U.S., and help us grow our innovation economy. And I think what we're doing right now is doing almost the opposite of that, is encouraging them to harvest our education systems and build these other countries up as superpowers that are going to compete with us on as innovation engines.
You guys are making me hungry for some more science, and I want to come back to the projects each of you are in the midst of. Anita, if I could start with you. Take us back now. You're going to have a device the size maybe of a cell phone. What? You get a drop of blood or a drop of saliva, and from that, with nanotechnology and all the rest, you're going to be able to identify, you hope, what the problem is, if there's a problem. How... I mean, we're not nanotechnologists necessarily, but take us, how would that work?
Well, let's start with what is nanotechnology. Nanotechnology, you know, conventionally refers to nanoscale, which is 10 to the minus 9 meters, and things that happen on that scale.
Molecular scale.
Molecular and in, exactly. And it, what I like to think of it is nanotechnology is really more of a trend. It's the ability to control and probe matter and systems on increasingly finer scales. Mm-hmm. And as we learn how to control matter on increasingly finer scales, new capabilities come out of that, new kinds of control over, for example, material properties. What we do is we exploit this capability of controlling molecules mm-hmm. at increasingly finer scales to detect and identify them more precisely, more accurately, to be able to get a signal out of, for example, the genetic code that's in your in some kind of biological organism mm-hmm. and be able to get an instant or a quick readout of what that would be.
The military is interested in case there's a bioweapon. They want to know what has hit this soldier, but it could work for anybody who's facing any kind of pathology.
Absolutely.
Disease.
The military actually has played an interesting role in our country in fueling economic innovation because DARPA, for example, some people would argue, helped fuel the development of the Internet mm-hmm. because they invest in high-risk, high-reward technologies.
So what's your biggest challenge? You want to get in there at the genetic, molecular level and figure out, you know, what's ailing the patient. What's the biggest challenge you're facing to get over the hump and actually do that?
You mean
technologically
or economically?
Of course, it always takes money, but scientifically, technologically.
Well, we have developed a certain level of proof of concept already through our previous R&D efforts. We're actually now getting into an engineering phase where we're
Why isn't it happening already? If it's easy or if it can be done, why isn't it happening now? What's the breakthrough
It really leverages a paradigm difference in how we approach. Traditionally, people look at this problem purely through biology, the tools of molecular biology and biochemistry. Mm-hmm. We actually leverage physics and some capabilities enabled by physics to actually be able to do things with these molecules that you couldn't otherwise do when you purely look at it in a biological way.
Are you going to solve the healthcare crisis? Will we not need hospitals full of doctors, but just somebody with a handheld device to diagnose?
I actually envision a similar paradigm shift occurring here that we saw in the telecom industry when computing and communications devices became portable. As we take the ability to diagnose disease out of a pathology lab in a hospital into doctors' hands, patients' hands, and even into rural villages.
Garrett Camp, all right, everybody turns to the Internet these days. They want to learn things. Why is it going to be better if I've got a lot of people, people who use StumbleUpon have a kind of a toolbar. Wherever they go, they can rate the site that they've been to.
Yep.
So, I mean, is this a significant advance or is this just fun?
I don't think it's a significant advance. I think it's just a natural progression. I think the first stage of the web was kind of very people organizing lists of sites, a lot like Yahoo. Mm-hmm. Then you move towards a search paradigm where there was, you know, so many pages that you could no longer organize that manually. You had to have, you know,
then comes
computers.
Google.
Then comes Google, and that's the second phase. And the third phase is going to be kind of somewhere in between, where you use technology to sort through the information, but you still use people to kind of endorse what's good.
Does it advantage the United States if you succeed, or just raise the bar globally? I mean, this Internet's available everywhere.
I believe it's good for everyone. Basically, what we're trying to do is solve the issue of information overload. I mean, right now there's so many web pages out there, mm-hmm. it's no longer realistic to be able to type a couple words in a search box and get the most relevant result. Mm. And what we're trying to do is set up these networks of people who... you know that they are your colleagues or your friends, and they've endorsed particular content on the web, and make it really easy for you to retrieve that content.
So don't waste time. Go right there.
Right to the relevant information.
David Berry, you've got maybe the biggest challenge we're looking at, energy in your lap here, microbes that are going to help us face that. I wish you'd give us a little more of the technology, a little more of the science about how that might work.
Sure. So the goal that we really set out to achieve was answer the question of, if you're going to produce a fuel-based form of energy, what's the best thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty obvious to us from a thermochemical, thermodynamic standpoint that petroleum, given its energy density, is an ideal thing to produce.
Mm-hmm.
So we set out and designed a theoretical biochemical pathway, found a series of enzymes that exist throughout nature in a number of organisms,
mm-hmm.
and were able to assemble them into a single already existing organism.
In other words, you're snipping little genetic bits from here and there and mushing them together or engineering them together in one organism.
Exactly. Coupling them all together through synthetic biology to make this organism do something it normally doesn't do.
Turn it into a gas pump.
For all intents and purposes, yes.
Okay, but is it sugars-based? I mean, you did a lot of your research in sugars. Of course, there's a lot of energy in sugars.
Exactly.
So is it on a sugars model as opposed to a, clearly it's obviously not petroleum. Boy, I'm at the limits of my scientific inquiry here.
Well, we like think of it as a biorefinery, the ultimate biorefinery, i.e. we take a common biological input. Just about every cell will use sugar in some way or another,
mm-hmm.
and we engineer in a way that it can convert this sugar in a metabolically favorable approach to something that has a lot of energy and something that we can harvest from the cell very easily. We can change what we're producing to a whole number of products, all of which you would find in petroleum, or things that you might have to process petroleum to get.
So this is genetic engineering and biochemistry. You said something earlier about pulling it out of the air. What do you pull out of the air?
So that refers more to the life cycle that we're trying to hit on, which is, if you think more broadly, what you're doing ultimately is you're taking CO2 from the air. That gets taken up by a plant. That plant,
right.
For example, if you're thinking about miscanthus or any other cellulosic source, ultimately gets processed into sugars,
mm-hmm.
i.e. glucose.
Mm-hmm.
You put that glucose from whatever source it happens to be into these organisms,
mm-hmm.
these engineered organisms. You produce your petroleum product. That petroleum product then gets put into, say, a fuel that gets burned.
Do you have to truck it around, or do the microbes live at the gas station?
We can do one of a number of things. We can do this as a just-in-time, just-in-place, put the microbes somewhere locally, but more likely we're going to build big plants in the same way that we're thinking about with ethanol today. The difference here is that our pipelines are meant to be transporting petroleum. So if we're smart about where we put these plants and put them close to a pipeline, we can put it into existing infrastructure and not have to worry about truck-based transportation.
And what's the output here? What's the exhaust, the pollution factor? Same as petroleum or different?
Well, if you burn a gallon of what we're doing, you burn a gallon of what comes up from the ground, it's the same. But because we can use these cellulosic sources, we can be close to, if not entirely, net CO2 neutral.
Okay. And when do I see, David Berry's gas station microbe pump at an intersection near me?
Well, our goal is to have an LS9 fuel in every vehicle. We're trying to get it to market in the 2009 to 2010 timeframe.
And could it someday be a substitute for petroleum?
We'd like it to be the basis of petroleum if we could get it there.
Okay, John Kao, this is pretty big stuff. If just we get these two, three, and another 100 like them, it sounds like maybe the U.S. is going to be okay. Sure thing.
Well, it's mouthwatering, and obviously the talent and the zeal of these three innovators comes through, and it's very, very hopeful. I think if we look for bright spots, we do have bright spots in America. The question is really what we as a country need to do, not just to have a few bright spots like MIT and Stanford. By the way, MIT is now setting up a campus in Singapore, so we're not just exporting talent, but we're exporting our major institutions as well. So the question, I think, for us as a country is how we can be wise enough to be good stewards of our assets, our talent, our knowledge, our wealth, not just to conserve what we have, but to really go boldly into the future, much as we've done wave after wave in our history. And so to do that, we need to understand that innovation is a challenge for our country, and it's not just about one piece of it, like the education system or the R&D system.
Yep.
But it's the combination of these things. We need to connect the dots And we need to hope for wise leadership that's going to help frame these issues in a way that we can have a truly useful national innovation strategy.
John Kao, you've been a great guide today. The new book is Innovation Nation. Thank you for joining us. David Barry, Garrett Camp, Anita Goel, thumbs up, thumbs down. Are you optimistic?
Very much so.
Yes, definitely.
We've got three heads nodding, and that's a comfort. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.